Honestly, we got about 10 days, maybe 2 weeks, before the bottom really drops out. Think unemployment benefits, gang. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday, today, the 16th of July. Good as always to have you along, everybody. It can be a bit numbing. I get it. Thursday after Thursday after Thursday, those first-time unemployment claims we keep telling you about. Another 1.3 million last week, the 17th week in a row. It's been over a million people newly asking for help. About 14 million people right now are getting that extra $600 a week in unemployment benefits that was part of the CARES Act. It's an extra $600 a week that goes away at the end of the month. The macroeconomic peril of that, in the absence of congressional action aside, there is a study out today from the J.P. Morgan Chase Institute, that's their think tank, looking at how people are spending that extra cash and what might happen if and when it's not there anymore. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer gets us going.
Fiona Gregg wanted to know what was happening to the extra $600 a week unemployed workers are getting right now. Gregg is director of consumer research at the J.P. Morgan Chase Institute, a think tank affiliated with the bank. Gregg says normally jobless workers receiving unemployment cut their spending by around 7%. So that's what she was expecting. But she was wrong, very wrong.
What's really surprising about this is actually we're seeing their spending soar. It's soaring by about 10%.
The study used J.P. Morgan Chase account data for about 61,000 anonymous households receiving unemployment. Gregg says those households spent almost 73 cents of every dollar they received. Michelle Evermore with the National Employment Law Project says that spending is keeping some sectors of the economy afloat.
Local hardware stores, rent. I'm worried about the housing market if the $600 disappears.
The extra money is set to disappear at the end of this month, unless Congress renews it. Ernie Tedeschi has been looking at how the entire economy would fare without it. He's an economist at Evercore ISI. He says if it went away entirely,
that would be like taking out $80 billion a month in support from the economy. By the end of the year, the economy would be 2% smaller.
Tedeschi says if Congress cut the $600 benefit in half and started giving the unemployed $300 extra a week, the economy would still contract by 1%. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Under the overall subject heading of how are we doing negotiating this pandemic, what's going to happen with kids and school is among the most pressing of this moment. The Los Angeles Unified School District, the second biggest in the country, is not going to open campuses this fall. Same thing down the coast in San Diego. Together, that's more than 800,000 students, just two of dozens, probably hundreds of districts, trying to work a really difficult problem with really significant implications. Because a lot of households have two parents working from home right now, but moms are bearing the brunt of kid duty, and that could have professional ramifications down the line. From the Workplace Culture Desk, Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has more on that one.
From her New Jersey house, Karen Sachs runs a startup that helps women commercial photographers find gigs. But she spends a lot of her day now trying to escape her two young boys.
I'm hiding in a room in my house, hoping that my children do not come and find me.
Though her husband is also working from home, only mommy will do when the kids are hungry or hurt or fighting.
It's me who they come to. It's my door that they open.
Like many moms, she's been left with fewer hours and less energy to focus on her own work. A new analysis of federal data co-authored by Caitlin Collins at Washington University in St. Louis finds mothers have scaled back their work hours during the pandemic 4 to 5 times more than fathers in heterosexual households where both parents are working from home.
And so it really is in these everyday small interactions that we see gender inequality playing out in the labor force.
They could be more vulnerable to layoffs, less likely to be promoted and paid less than male or childless peers.
And that does just continue to perpetuate inequality at work and at home.
Bridget Schulte is the director of the Better Life Lab at New America. She says moms have long shouldered the bulk of unpaid labor at home, even as the majority work full time. That often leads to a vicious cycle of pursuing less demanding careers, receiving lower pay, and then continuing to sacrifice work to accommodate a higher earning spouse.
Because if that earner loses benefits or loses pay or loses their job, you don't have much of a safety net.
It's just one more way the pandemic has turned out to be less the great leveler, more the great amplifier of existing inequities. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Wall Street today was lousy and did less lousy. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. You saw the tweets, right? Or the coverage of it anyway, the big Bitcoin Twitter hack. Amusing in a way, not especially damaging, and yet we got kind of lucky. Zeynep Tufekci writes on technology and society, teaches at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill as well. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you for inviting me.
So let's say these people yesterday who did this Twitter hack were more clever, more evil, more malicious, and decided instead of doing the Bitcoin thing, they wanted to do actual economic damage. How do you suppose that might have gone down?
Well, let me up that for you. Let's say okay. that they tweeted from the president's accounts that the missiles are on their way to China and then went to news accounts like Associated Press or NPR and other places and confirmed it. China would have about 20 minutes to figure this out, and hopefully they would figure it out. But the kind of role Twitter plays in our information ecology, especially with the president and many other official agencies first tweeting without necessarily other quick ways of verification, there's so many scenarios. I just gave you a terrible one to say how high the stakes are, but they could have done a lot.
This is something that we kind of already knew, right? I mean, hacks happen right and left. The president is inconsistent on Twitter, and there's a case to be made you wouldn't know he'd been hacked based on what the content of the tweet was. What does this tell us about our vulnerability?
Well, the important thing to remember here is we keep telling people, you know, use two-factor authentication, do this, do that to protect yourself. But the reality is the biggest threat is an insider threat like this. Some employee inside the company that has access to what the computer science people would call the God view. Like you get to see everything at the same time. And that's just scary because imagine they had tweeted out a coordinated and subtle thing that there was some, you know, major crisis somewhere and the stock market tanked. And in the 15 minutes the stock market tanked, they made a lot of money. And since this thing has happened before, insider attacks have happened before, it just means that we should remember this next time we see something like this, but we haven't really prepared for it, unfortunately.
You have been speaking and writing and trying to get your thoughts on this out for a very long time. Do you think we have it in us to fix this, or to not fall victim? I guess
I'm almost happy that these people tried a two-bit Bitcoin scam. To be honest, I'm. Sorry that some people may have lost a little bit of money. Hopefully it wasn't too much, but I hope that it's a warning because they could have done so much more damage so quickly and we wouldn't even realize what they'd done till it was too late. So the fact that they tried to just get a little bit of money is actually a favor to us to say, whoa, we are not ready. We are heading into an election and we have too many choke points in our information ecology that are concentrated in a few companies. I'm not saying let's not use these, but we need to not have them be this important a choke point with little accountability.
Zeynep Tufekci is an associate professor at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. She writes at The Atlantic as well on technology, privacy, and surveillance in this society. Thanks for your time, Professor. I appreciate it.
Thank you for inviting me.
This week on Earth 2, the Democratic Convention started on Monday in Milwaukee to nominate Joe Biden. Here in our reality, the Dems are going to have a virtual convention sometime later this summer. The GOP, meanwhile, having moved its gathering from Charlotte, North Carolina to Jacksonville to let more people gather, is now said to be scaling things back, seeing as how nobody checked with the virus and what its plans are. But look, even without conventions, candidates are going to be nominated and there's going to be an election, so why all the machinations? Yes, one big reason is to get those candidates a bunch of free media, granted. But as Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports, don't forget about the money.
When a big political convention came to town, at least in the before times, it juiced the local economy, sold out hotel rooms, packed convention centers, people coming from all over to spend money and ask for money. Sheila Krumholtz is at the Center for Responsive Politics.
It is an opportunity for the candidates to court the media and especially elite mega donors, where they have private affairs, where mega donors and candidates often are kind of ensconced in their own special party space.
And not just for the mega donors and big name candidates. Lisa King of Jacksonville, Florida, says she's been to every Democratic National Convention since 1992. At one point, she was running as a pro-union candidate for city council, and she says the convention gave her a boost.
It has been an opportunity for me to meet union leaders from all over our state and, in fact, outside our state boundaries. So I was able to raise money from local unions because they got an opportunity to meet me in person.
Having local officials, national politicians, and the media all in one place also presents a marketing opportunity for issue groups and businesses.
For example, I had never heard of Uber until the 2012 Democratic National Convention in Charlotte. But we had a coupon in our delegate bags to allow us to use Uber while we were in Charlotte.
Conventions can be expensive for delegates. Hotels, travel, meals, it adds up. So according to convention veteran Lisa King, sponsored events offer free food and booze.
Delegates are on a budget, and so they do like to go to those events also because they're going to get fed.
King says what she'll miss most about an in-person convention this year is catching up with old friends, coordinating with other state politicians and activists, and being a part of history. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Have some empathy.
You heard the man. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's off 135 points today, about a half percent. Finished at 26,734. The NASDAQ down 76 points. That is 0.7%, 10,473. The S&P 500 dropped 10 points, 0.3%, 32.15. Told about the weekly unemployment insurance claims. Well, here you go. According to the Department of Labor, the biggest increases in those claims for the week ending July 4th were Texas, New Jersey, and Maryland. The biggest decreases, Indiana, Florida, and California. Talked about Twitter a little bit, down 1% after that hack. Facebook posted up 0.2%. Snap, parent O Snapchat, dropped 2.6% on the day. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Back before everything went sideways, before any of us knew what social distancing or PPE or PPP meant, before we knew what kind of year this economy and all of us were going to have, we started a series called The United States of Work. 10 people who are a roughly representative sample of the American labor force. The first of the 10 that we introduced you to was a certified public accountant in New York City named Michael Durant. And now that delayed tax day is in the rearview mirror, we have gotten him back on the phone to check in. Michael, it's good to talk to you again.
It's good to talk to you, Kai.
So here we are in July. Let's do work stuff first, right? You have just finished your heavy season. What's it like for you to be working deep into the summertime as an accountant?
It almost felt like it was 6 months straight of busy season, even with the lows of the virus coming in and, you know, having to pack up and change locations. It just felt like there was so much to do during the day.
I'm shocked that people put off their taxes all the way through this pandemic. Has your work changed at all? I mean, can you do accounting from your, you know, kitchen table, as it were?
Oh, yes. I mean, our firm had taken an initiative early on to be remote capable. And I had, luckily for school, I had purchased like a dual screen monitor setup back for like my own Christmas present. So it came in handy, actually, with this entire switch.
So let's talk about school for a second, because as listeners will know, not only are you working full time, you're in law school at night. Have you been online, I guess, for, you know, the last semester or so?
Yeah, exactly. We went online, I want to say sometime mid-March, similar to everybody else for the fall. It's still up in the air. They're contemplating some hybrid method or just online like we've been doing.
What are you hearing from your clients about how their businesses and personal lives are going?
It depends on what industry they're in. We have some restaurants who have reopened, some who just haven't at all. But everyone's working at a slower and at a fraction of what they were doing just 6 months ago.
Yeah, what's their level of hope for the short-term future? Do you have a sense?
It's not much hope. It's more like walking on a sheet of ice on a lake. Like you see it cracking and you're just trying to get to the other side and hoping that it maintains. Right now, with no government certainty about what type of relief there will be, it's kind of just everyone's just kind of inching across.
Yeah, yeah. I need to delve into the personal here for a minute with you because this pandemic has hit you hard. Your mom passed because of COVID back in April, right?
Yes, she did.
First of all, how you doing?
You know, I'm doing okay. You know, given the circumstances, I'm doing all right. You know, I have my two younger brothers, and we're pretty close-knit to begin with, and then this only kind of brought us closer. So, you know, it's good to have them as a support system.
When we were there in December, we took the subway up to Yankee Stadium. You and your brother AJ lived in you had your own apartment, and your brother AJ lived with your mom in an apartment in the same building, and we came up to see you. He's what now, like a senior in high school?
He will be in September, yes.
So how's he doing? I mean, because this is, you know, senior in high school, you want to start thinking colleges, and he's had this horrible loss. How's he doing?
Mm-hmm. He's doing okay. You know, everybody's just, you know, given the circumstances again, but we've gotten a bit closer. We've been talking colleges and, you know, what the future holds. And of course, the first thing was, oh, my brother's in charge now, so maybe I get a little more slack, but I'm going to keep a tight leash on him a little bit longer. But yeah, we've been talking college.
Yeah. We talked about that night we were up there, about how you're kind of tough on him, which, yeah, I mean, you were pretty upfront about that. So let's see, you are working full time. You're going to school. You are now, you're AJ's guardian, right?
Yes.
So you're the guardian to a 17-year-old kid. You're moving into your mom's old apartment, right? You're selling your place. How have you been able to process all this? Or have you? Or are you just kind of going about the motions here?
I think it's more like going about the motions. Everything's coming real fast. You know, I have enough room to breathe where it's not overwhelming. And at the same time, it's just a lot to deal with. But Things are moving at a good pace, and especially now with the city reopening bit by bit, it's speeding things up a little bit.
How are you taking care of yourself? I mean, you know, self-care is kind of important, especially at a time like this.
Definitely. I do make coffee every day. I make a good, solid Spanish Bustelo coffee, black, one sugar, and it's like the highlight reel. It's almost like transports me to another location. And then spending time with my brothers, me and AJ have definitely started watching a lot of movies together and stuff.
Well, that's good. That's good. Michael, thanks for your time. I really appreciate it. And, take care of yourself, please. Life is tough, man.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Hi.
The transit system of the city of New York, the MTA, is critical infrastructure that supports about 8% of the entire American economy. At least it was. Right now, ridership is down more than 90%. The MTA figures it's going to lose more than $14 billion through next year. And so, as Marketplace's Justin Ho reports, it is scrounging for cash.
The MTA has a hard time making ends meet, even during normal times. Nick Cifuentes is the executive director of the Tri-State Transportation Campaign.
There's only so much that any public transit agency can rely on the fare box.
The MTA is hoping to make up for its $14 billion shortfall with a patchwork of aid. It's received $4 billion from Washington, and it's asking for an additional $4 billion. But the bill that would provide that is held up in the Senate. Meanwhile, Cifuentes says the agency is looking for any port in a storm to make up for the $10 billion it still needs.
For the MTA, when you're drowning, any rope is an option, even a frayed one.
One of the ropes the MTA is reaching for runs to the Federal Reserve. John Caney at the watchdog group Reinvent Albany says the Fed's municipal liquidity facility could give the MTA a $3 billion loan.
The MTA rolls over billions of dollars of short-term debt every year. So this would actually just be another short-term lending source.
How short? The Fed's loans have to be paid back in no more than 3 years. Caney says that's a tight time frame.
Who the heck is going to be able to pay back this loan in 3 years, given the fact that the COVID revenue damage is expected to continue at least all the way through the end of 2021?
And the Fed loans aren't cheap. Seth Lehman at the ratings agency Fitch analyzed how the Fed's municipal liquidity facility compared to more traditional forms of borrowing, like government bonds.
And it was much more expensive versus other traditional choices.
Those costs are one reason why other big transit agencies haven't turned to the Fed, says Baruch Feigenbaum of the Reason Foundation.
The question is this the best way for them to borrow? Is this the cheapest rate? And I don't know that it is.
The MTA has said that its costs are high wherever it borrows money. Without additional funding, the authority says it might have to scale back its $55 billion plan to modernize the subway. For now, all new projects are on hold. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
It has been years that the restaurant industry has been complaining about Yelp, specifically about negative reviews and the business damage those reviews can do. Now, with all the pandemic-induced forced switching to takeout, and even that not really being enough to keep restaurants going, restaurant owners and some of their employees are saying things have got to change. Marketplace's Jasmine Garst has more on that.
For years, restaurant owners have been complaining about unfair Yelp reviews. Joshua Chasen is a bartender and food industry organizer in Portland.
You know, a real negative teardown sort of review can be really disastrous.
And for an industry that has lost about $120 billion just in the first 3 months of the COVID-19 shutdown, every customer counts. Paulie Giannone, who goes by Paulie G in Brooklyn, owns several pizzerias. He's gotten quite a few mean Yelp reviews, like one customer who called a takeout cashier a hipster window boy.
First of all, don't call a man a boy, okay? In this time, for people to be slamming restaurants who are struggling just to keep their doors open, forget about making money. You know, people should go easy.
Recently, Yelp posted this advice to reviewers on its website. Many restaurants are experiencing more takeout and delivery orders than ever before. Be understanding, considerate, and support your local businesses. But Joshua Chasen from Portland says now more than ever, Yelp should take some responsibility for what is written on its site.
Could there be a better job done by Yelp to moderate negative reviewers? Yes.
Paulie G in Brooklyn says most of his reviews are good, and he's trying to take the knocks with a dash of humor. He recently got his cashier a t-shirt to wear at work. It reads, "Hipster Window Boy." I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
It's going to be my new podcast, Hipster Window Boy. All right, this final note on the way out today, to which I say nay, I will not have it. Zoom, with which those of us who are working from home right now are all too familiar, is making its first venture into hardware, something called a personal collaboration device, $599 for a 27-inch touchscreen with 3 wide-angle cameras and 8 microphones. No. All right, we got to go. Not without this very quick moment of economic context. We learned this morning retail sales were up 7.5% last month, which is great. You know what's supporting all those retail sales? All those extra unemployment benefits that go away in like 10 days, 2 weeks to get us back where we started. All right, we're out of here. Amir Babawi, Siobhan Brett, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Kat Green, Rick Carr, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.